come to order. First bill on the agenda is House File 82. Representative Noren. And the chair will move House File 82. Get it before the committee. Representative Noren.
Well, thank you. There are a few that aren't here yet, I take it, but...
couldn't wait to get here for this, Mr.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 82 was brought to me by the City of Fergus Falls, specifically brought to me at the request of the Director of the Port Authority in the city. And what the legislation does, currently, if the city population is over 5,000, you can hold that property, your property that you're planning to develop for a period of 15 years. So all cities 5,000 and smaller have that option. Larger communities can only hold that property for a period of 8 years. And there was a time when that 8 years, I believe, applied to everybody. And I'm not sure when the change took place, but at some point in time, the 5,000 population was decided to be a little different and treated differently. And that's when that particular population size was extended to 15 years. I should say that Gordon Hajdukovic is the executive director of Port Authority, and he would be here, but he's been suffering from the same crud that a lot of people have, and the medication he's on doesn't allow him to drive, so that's why he's not here today. So he apologizes. As I've talked to Gordon, his understanding is that with the current situation with the economy, a case can be made to say that even a city the size of, say, 15,000, which this legislation addresses, would have the same difficulty in developing the property as a city of 5,000 or less. And so that's the purpose. We feel that any community in the city of Fergus, in the state of Minnesota, that fits that 15,000 population or under might be benefiting if we extend the period of time to 15 years. I haven't, counted up, but the fiscal note that you have, I guess, actually is taken and totaled up the number of communities that would be impacted. There's 43 that fit that 15,000 population or under. If you have a copy of the fiscal note, it doesn't really bear out any cost to the state of Minnesota. They do indicate there may be some cost to local taxpayers, but again, there's no evidence to know what that is. And I guess that's perhaps the extent of the story. If there's any questions?
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know, Representative Nornes or maybe staff can indicate what the reasoning was behind the 5,000 population limit in the first place.
Does staff have an answer to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, as I recall, and this goes back, I don't know how many years, but it's probably, I'm guessing, 15 years at least when the change was made where there was a split, that the smaller cities came in and argued that these smaller cities needed more time to pull together packages of development, and that for that reason that 8 years needed to be expanded. And I think the 5,000, and as I recall, and I should have looked at the history, I think we've changed the number of years from when it originally, because I'm not sure it went from the 8 to 15 in the first change that the legislature made. I think we had an 8 to something else, like 8 to 10 or 8 to 12 or something in between, and then it was changed subsequently to 15. But I think the 5,000 was just to look at just smaller cities, and so I'm not sure that there was anything magical about the 5, other than it takes longer in smaller cities to do that economic development kind of issues of pulling parcels together and getting parcels developed, and that was the rationale.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Baker, I don't recall the different classes of cities and the parameters of the classes. I'm just wondering if we're giving the authority to something in the middle of a class, or, is it the entire class, or what are we doing here?
Can you tell us what we're doing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, I'm 98% sure that the classes are over 20,000 and then 10 to 20. So I think you're exactly right that this would be in between the definitions of the classes. But
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if we shouldn't, Representative Nornes, at least put the level at either the lower section of the class or the higher section of the class, so that the entire class of cities has the same opportunity as everybody else within that class.
I would certainly be open to making it 20. Wouldn't be real favorable about 10, however.
Representative Nelson, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Nornes, has there been any discussion or even thought what this might do as far as being a carrot for cities to want to do some annexation of large parcels of land, knowing full well and good they don't have to have a plan for development if they can hold on to them for such a long period of time, even though that they all of a sudden go over that magic tipping point of 5,000 population?
Representative Nelson, that has not been part of the discussion. I know in the city of Fergus Falls that's not in the plan. That's not the reason for this, at least that I'm aware of. The city has annexed some property at the request of the property owners recently, but that's the only thing that I'm aware of. So I don't have a better answer than that.
Representative Nelson.
I guess Representative Nornes, what makes me hinky about this is I can easily see another Chisago City to go for another 11,000 acres, or Forest Lake to take an entire township, or Monticello, or so on and so forth. For that reason, I guess I do like Representative Broad's line of thought in scaling down the number, that if they find the third person, not necessarily the same city, that in a few years that economic development is still not coming. I guess I'd rather take smaller bites than try to eat that whole apple at once.
Actually, Representative Nelson, I think Representative Broad was increasing the population.
Go the other way, so.
You'd like to go the other way. Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going off of Representative Broad's line of thought, I think the one thing that we're seeing in rural Minnesota and in some of these communities is we are having economic development and we are having growth in our regional cities. And that's what's happening here in Fergus Falls, the case that Representative Nornes has brought this forward. And that's good. And that's good news, because we aren't having declining. And if we were in here looking to reduce it the other direction, I think it would be a pretty scary thought. So I think this is a good approach, but I do think that Representative Broad is correct. I think maybe we should raise it to the 20,000 threshold so that we do keep it in that same classification.
Representative Broad.
Well, Mr. Chair, my name has been taken in vain quite a bit here, and I'm not sure it's in vain or not, but I'm not so sure I'm suggesting 20%. I just am asking the question. I just want to clarify that.
So whether it should stay in that class.
No, it's your fault.
Representative Nornes, does the League of Cities have a position on this?
I have not heard from them.
No. You haven't heard from anybody? How about the townships?
Same. I have not heard from them.
Okay.
This is a local request primarily. I mean, it comes from the city of Fergus Falls. We had the same request last year. However, the bill didn't along with other things, didn't finish the line. It didn't get to the finish line. So,
one could ask, though, if there is economic activity, why would you need more time then instead of less? If you're going to, as Representative Nelson kind of alluded to, if a city is going to annex some land maybe next to it but doesn't have a plan to do anything with it for 15 years.
Mr. Chair, I think the only reason 15 years is being talked about is that that's the current number for the smaller cities. The city of Fergus Falls perhaps would be happy with less than that, but that changes. Then it would be. I guess what we're trying to do is make this a simple change without affecting too many other things, just by giving them more time. I don't think they see 15 years as something that's really that needed, because as Representative Simpson said, we've had economic development and continual. But if you happen to be coming up to that 8-year limit and haven't quite got all your pieces together yet, that's, I think, what the city is concerned about.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And a question for staff here. Is there a limit right now for metro cities on this population? Yeah, see, this is referring to non-metro, but right now, can metro cities of any population hold economic land for 15 years?
Ms. Baker?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Marquardt, yes, it's the 8 years. I mean, if you look at the language, what it is the holding of property by a vertical subdivision of the state for later resale for economic development should be considered a public purpose for a period not to exceed 8 years. And then there's this exception. And the exception is for property that's located in a city of the 5,000 that's not in the metro has a longer period. So the 8 years is the standard.
Thank you. Thank you.
Any other questions from members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
There may be staff could inform me. I mean, what the original intent of this was an economic development type thing. But what I don't understand is this property that had been confiscated, or is it just property that was purchased, or both? And because I know the chair especially is very concerned about taking a property, and as I am on property rights issues. So, what's going on here, Ms. Baker, Mr. Hines, as far as those two questions are concerned.
Ms. Baker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, not sure I can totally answer that question other than this was just trying to address how long a city can hold property for economic development purposes.
But what I'm asking, Ms. Baker or Mr. Hines, is it property that they took for a public purpose from a private enterprise and then they're just going to sit on it, or is it property that they, like Chair Vanderveer asked, that they annex maybe from a next door township and they're just going to sit on it, or is it property that was just there and vacant and they decided to use it for economic development and they sit on it?
Ms. Baker?
Chair, Representative Rukavina, I don't think, I mean, this doesn't address that at all. I think it could be any property. So I think it could be any or all of what you're talking about. It's just that they can't hold this property. Hold any property for longer than the 8-year period or the 15. I don't know if Joel is here, and I don't know if he knows more about this provision because of the economic development issues that have come up.
Well, maybe just a hypothetical. Let's say that there's a certain ugly gas station that a city council doesn't like, so they decide that they're going to take it for economic development purposes, and then they sit on it for 8 years and they don't do anything with it, and now they're going to be able to sit on it for 15 years. Would that be the correct hypothetical for what this bill could do?
Representative Darnman would make them paint it. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rivadina. I would think so, but this is not trying to address eminent domain or any of the other kind of issues of how they got the property.
Well,
but this is how long they actually can hold it for economic development purposes.
So, Ms. Baker, any way they want to get it within their abilities
with
now.
Other provisions of law that are out there, you know, and this is not addressing any of those.
Mr. Chair, I'm aware of that. I'm just trying to understand why it was there and what the implications of the extension could be, and I'm trying to think if I'm, you know, off and, you know, on a tangent in one of my dream worlds, which I can occasionally be in, or if I'm kind of off mark here as far as a potential case that could happen. And I see Representative Abrams is shaking his head that I'm not off on a too big of a tangent this time, but even a broken watch is right twice a day. I know. am I right this time?
Representative Narnas.
Mr. Chair, again, we can go off on all kinds of hypotheticals here. In the specific case of Purchase Falls, what the city is looking at is a substantial amount of property that's currently owned by the state of Minnesota that the RTC sits on.
Mm-hmm.
It's 150, 60 acres, something like that, that the city basically is agreeing to take over and will be redeveloping that, given some time. It's a large piece of real estate. It has some challenges. In addition to that, there's other property that's owned by the DNR that's adjacent to the city that perhaps is... And so the city's been working in a lot of different ways to acquire some of this property, and... right now, it's a little more than perhaps they really need. And so that's part of the reason for coming to you and asking for a little more time.
So, Mr. Representative Narnas, this is state-owned land or state agency-held land that they're contemplating, and they just would like, before they make that commitment, to have more than 8 years to deal with it. Is that?
I think that's part of the plan. It's not total plan, but that's part of it. And the state is very, very excited about somebody being willing to take that property, which, you know, again, has its challenges. And so I think that's part of the reason for changing this, so that we have a little more time. Just for the committee to know, we've had some property in our community that's taken up to 30 years to redevelop. And so it's not unusual to have a quantity of, a large amount of time that's needed in order to put together what will work in rural Minnesota. And so 15 years seems like a long time, but again, I've seen property that's been idle for 30 and finally brought back to life. And that's happened about 3 times in our community. The latest is a government center building that's now on the RTC campus that's been empty. And it's now revitalized. That took over 20 years to redevelop that property.
Representative Nelson, you had another question?
I do. And while I certainly have no qualms about trying to help Fergus Falls in this area, the bill talks about the metropolitan area, and I need somebody to define which definition we're using. Are we using the 7 county? Are we using the 11 county? Or are we using MnDOTs, which is 7 counties plus 1?
Chairman, Representative Nelson, it's the 7 counties.
So, Representative Nornis, you've got us off on annexation. Good job.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions? Or?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abrams.
Well, first, my members, I think that 8 years is too long. You know, we require expenditures in TIF districts with the knockdown road to be committed within 5 years. I think this is an example of a real problem, which is for Fergus Falls, the RTC was a large employer, a large presence in town, and the city wants to do something with it, and it may take more than 8 years. But I think this is an example of using a general law provision, which will take in every city under 15,000 in greater Minnesota, when it may make sense to try to fashion something for if it's owned by a unit of government over a certain amount of acres or whatever in order to take care of the specific situation in Fergus Falls, which I have a great deal of sympathy for, Representative Nornes. So, you know, there may be a way in which to fashion this in a not so broad fashion, but the idea of members of cities land banking for 15 years, having the property off the property tax roll, some of the issues that Representative Rukavina raised, I really think are real ones, and we certainly don't want to have an incentive for cities to engage in takings and then basically bank the land for up to 15 years. I don't think that's the author's intent. I think the author's intent is dealing with a specific situation in Fergus, and I think that narrower language can take care of that issue.
Mr. Chair, I don't think you'll find any of those communities of 5,000 or less either that are looking to be slow about development. They're just realizing that it's slow. It takes a long time to attract somebody to a small community so you can redevelop some of this property. And what Fergus Falls basically is saying that it's not much different for 15,000 population than it is for 5. It's a slow process. And maybe 15 years is too long, but that's current language for the 5,000 population. It maybe ought to be something less than that. But again, trying to be simple, I guess, and not change too many things, and we've decided to stay with the 15, but just in increase the population.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abrams.
I don't know if the question should be directed at Ms. Baker or Mr. Michael, but there are a whole lot of provisions of municipal law that kick in for cities of greater than 5,000. As for cities of less than 5,000, and you know, I guess we can, you know, ask the staff to go through it, but that's the usual break point on a number of things. 2,500 is also a break point too, isn't it, Mr. Hines? I think for MSA purposes, for state aid highways, for the state aid system, I think it's 5,000, and there's a number of others. I don't know anywhere else in the law in which the cutoff is 15,000. I may be mistaken, but they're basic gradations that have their antecedents in cities of first class, second class, third class, towns, etc. And that's why it's 5,000, Representative Nornes. Mm-hmm. It certainly wasn't a number that was just plucked out of the air. Additionally, in the fifth and abatement law, there's some different provisions for under 5,000, cities of under 5,000. So, you know, if we did this for a city of 15,000 and have a new standard, what I'd be worried about is that every other provision that has a 5,000 threshold, there'll be advocates in to change that. And I guess, Representative Norris, I disagree with you to the point that there is a difference between a city of 5,000 and a city of 15,000. City of 15,000 will have more professional staff, et cetera, more services available. They may even have their own police and fire department in some circumstances, where I don't believe you're going to find very many towns of under 5,000 with that. They normally contract through the county for a lot of the services. So that's where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
It may be arbitrary, Representative Nornes, but that's right. Where it came from.
Right. Well, Representative Broad, Mr. Chair, had suggested we go to 20, or maybe hadn't suggested it exactly, but brought it up.
She's regretting that now.
No, Mr. Chair, just for clarifying once again. Wow. No, my whole point in the question was just saying we're doing something in the middle of a class of city.
Right.
And if we're going to do it, we ought to do it for the entire class, whether that class starts at 20 or 10. But it's just changing rules within a class of cities is where my concern is.
Okay. Representative Nornes, would you be willing maybe to work with staff to narrow this down and get something maybe that fits the RTC situation?
Well, again, I'm not sure I want to narrow it exclusively to the RTC because there is other property that the city... Like I mentioned, the DNR has property adjacent to the industrial park that I'm sure that would be part of the discussion as well.
Well,
if we're making it specific,
right,
to RTC, I don't think that's exactly what the city has intended. But I'll be willing to work with staff to answer your question. But
Representative Nornes, I would suggest that you work with her and maybe government-owned land or work somewhere around in those parameters so that it is much narrower than it is now.
If that's your wishes.
Well, it's just a suggestion.
Yes.
Anyone in the audience that cares to testify for or against the bill?
Mm-hmm. I only wish that Gordon had felt better. He would have had better answers probably than I did. So.
Okay.
All right.
The chair then will lay over House File 82 for possible inclusion in the omnibus property and local tax bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Ryan. Next on the agenda, Representative Rukavina, House File 169.
Mr. Chair, always. I'd like to move that House File 169 be moved to pass and put on a consent calendar.
Representative Rukavina moves that House File 169 be considered for possible inclusion in the property and local tax omnibus bill. Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, you know, these freshmen and that, they bring cookies and that to a committee, but they really don't know how to do this, you know. And so I brought this button today to the committee.
You can't read a button.
I'm sure that you're Ray can read it from here.
I can read it.
Mr. Chair.
Well, in that case, what did you want to do with Representative Rukavina?
Mr. Chair,
there's a block, though.
this bill, if you may recall, I had it introduced last year. House File 169 is a bill, and it never got in the tax bill. And I offered it as an amendment on the floor, and I think it passed 134 to nothing. And basically, what it does is, currently under current law, a disabled veteran falls into a category with other disabled folks. I think the tax rate is 0.45% on the first $32,000 of value, and this bill basically it does not charge veterans who are get a total disability in the line of duty any tax, property tax whatsoever, and it surprisingly saves the state. I believe I had a fiscal note from last year that said 1.2, but I think it's down to 1.02. So I just think that, you know, with everything going on in the world and us talking about veterans and doing things for them, that this would be a good tax policy for the state for someone who is totally disabled as a veteran in the line of duty. And it actually saves money because of the circuit breaker rebates that are given out. There's about 2,800, according to the Veterans Affairs, about 2,800 homeowners that would qualify for this, and if their average rebate is $500, that's where they come up with that figure. So I'd stand for any questions. I think it's a pretty straightforward bill, and I appreciate your support.
Representative Krenke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Rukavina, are we going to have the veterans police now? How do we know that the person applying for the exemption actually lives in the house?
Actually, Mr. Chair and Representative Krenke, there must be some type of criteria now that enables us to give them the current rebate under current law, and also, excuse me, the current tax exemption, and also the rebate. So there, I don't know, maybe staff can help me out how the documentation would take place, but I believe that the figures from the Veterans Affairs are pretty accurate as to the numbers. The actual mechanics of how revenue or whomever determines whether the veteran lives there or not. And I must add, well, I am answering you, Representative Crick, it does apply to the spouse, too, as long as, I believe, at least it did last year, and I thought it still does, the spouse, as long as she lives in the same house, or he. So maybe staff can, Mr. Hines or someone can help me now as how it works currently under today's laws for documentation purposes.
Mr. Hines, good
job. Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, the standard sort of rules of a homestead would apply in this situation the way we validate homestead property right now. So if the person owns the property and the assessor is satisfied that that's their home, then they are eligible for homestead currently, and they'd be under qualify for this exemption. As Representative Rukavina pointed out, there's also a provision that allows this benefit to carry over to the spouse of the veteran if the veteran dies. And you might look on page 2, paragraph D, says that once an owner qualifies, property continues to qualify until there is a change in ownership of the property. So I think there's lots of ways to say that if the veteran would eventually go to some kind of a living, assisted living situation, as long as they continue to own the property, the property would still qualify, would be my interpretation.
Mr. Hines, would that mean then that if they owned that house, got the exemption, bought another house, rented this one out, that it would continue to qualify?
Mr. Chairman, that house then would no longer qualify as a homestead.
It has to be homestead.
But
okay.
But the house they bought subsequently, they would be eligible to get it on that home,
right,
but not the first one, right?
Okay. Representative Cranky, did you?
I'll take another question here, and that is if Representative Rukavina, does this apply to only one property, or Mr. Hines? I mean, just
only homes?
Yes. Mr. Hines?
Hey, yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm Cranky. It would just be the homes, as now you can only qualify for one homestead property. Here you'd only be able to be qualified one homestead to get the exemption.
Mr. Hines, you want to clarify for me? I've lost track over the years where we are with regard to homestead if a husband and wife, can they legally homestead two different properties?
Ms. Baker?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krinke, for the most part, your answer is no. There are a couple exceptions if they work, for instance, more than 50 miles away, and I can look in the statutes for a couple minor exceptions, but...
I'm sure my wife would like to live probably 50 miles away from me.
But for the most part, no. They can only have one homestead. And it doesn't even matter whose name is on the title. So, if the husband has the title to one property and the wife has the title to the other, as long as they are married, they still can only have one homestead unless they meet one of these qualifications.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, committee members and Representative Rupin, my thought process here is a situation where you had two properties you have that seasonal rec property, and then you have a home somewhere else in the state, and the possibility that you could circumvent what we're trying to accomplish here, but it's my only...
Mr. Chair, if there's a...
Representative Rukavina.
I don't believe under current law there's a way for him to do that, but if there is, Representative Finke, we can work on this. I think it's going to be a long time before we see the tax bill coming out of the tax committee, so I agree with you on that interpretation, but it's pretty difficult to do under current law for anyone right now.
Representative Brock?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Rukavina, do you have any idea, we can kind of place and count the number of veterans that this would affect, but do you know the average value of the homes that would be exempted under this provision?
Representative Cavina.
Mr. Chair, I don't represent Broad. All I do know is that there are 2,800 homeowners getting approximately a $500 rebate, and maybe on average, and maybe you could work backwards from there. And I don't know how you would do that. I'm looking at Mr. Hines, and he's kind of shaking his head no, but, you know, if you could work backwards on what the average value might be, but you'd have the income in there also, and it might be difficult to do. I don't know that.
Representative Brad?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know that Mr. Hines needs to actually give me that answer here. I've asked him to do things that I'm amazed that he's able to do in terms of numbers, but I guess I'm just wondering if there is going to be... you know, if there's a situation out there where you have $1 million home exempted, is that your intent that that would be covered under this legislation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, I guess it could technically be covered under this exemption, but I don't know very many disabled veterans living in $1 million homes. So I think the reality of that would be, you know, that it might be a real long shot in that area. So.
Representative Brad?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that, Representative Rukamina, in terms of a long shot. I'm just, if we have spouses covered and things like that, I don't know, and that's why I asked the question about the average value of the house. I just wondered who we're covering.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I, yesterday when I was looking at this bill too, Representative Brad, I did try to think, well, how could you, you know, because the fact of the matter is that this bill is a shift to other taxpayers, but when you look at 2,800 homes statewide, you know, the shift is probably pennies on any home in any taxing jurisdiction. And I was trying to think, just like you, that the question might come up, what is the total value of these homes? And I thought, well, you know, Mr. Hines is a pretty good wizard, and he probably could somehow, you know, come up with a formula that maybe could look at that $1.02 million in rebates and try to determine an average income and average value home. But, you know, the bottom line, members and Representative Broad, is that the shift to other properties in the taxing jurisdictions on $2,800 homes statewide is going to be really, really insignificant. And you might have an exception, like you said, about $1 million home. I think the way it's drafted, that we're looking at pretty average place homes, and that even with the spousal extension, that you're not going to really have any abuse in this at all. And if there are the other states that do this, Florida for one, and one of my constituents had seen that, what they were doing for totally disabled veterans. And then we did a little research. Mr. Hines helped me and saw that we were, you know, including our veterans in our disabled homestead laws, and we came up with these numbers, and the bill is here, and I guess we have just trust our instinct on it more than anything else. And then go by my button, too. So.
Any other questions, members? Representative Kroenke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Rukavina, what happens if I get in the governor's race?
I have buttons, and well, I was going to bring up your other home, but I wouldn't do that.
It's still in Minnesota.
It's in the right district.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, I have several properties around the state located in several different congressional districts.
Just in case.
Mr. Chair, can you run for two offices at one time? I don't know.
And Mr. Chair, I'm with you, Representative Greg.
Anyone in the audience care to testify for or against the bill? Okay. With that, Representative Rukavina renews his motion that House File 169 be laid over for possible consideration in the Property and Local Tax Division.
Thank you,
Member. This bill. Next bill on the agenda is House File 851. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Chairman Vandiver and committee members. The page has, I believe, three handouts. Committee members here, I think, are all familiar with the Metropolitan Fiscal Disparities Program. I do just want to say a couple things about that, so that just to refresh your memory. This is a study. This bill says let's study the program. We've had it 34 years. We've never studied it. Now, we all know last year we spent a lot of time trying to study and relook at LGA. This is another major aid program in the state of Minnesota that has never been studied. In fact, I think it's difficult to think of a program that has pretty much never been changed either. If you look at what the page is handing out, there's a beige sheet. That's the short subject from health research. There's the list that everyone always looks at, and that's the winners and losers. Currently, I think, and I didn't sit and manually count them, but I think there are 41 winners now, which is a new high, and I think last time we looked at this, they were in the high 30s. So there are a few more winners. There's some anomalies in there where there's some townships that really are just kind of flukes in the data that you have to discount. I think the net recipients are about 135. So this is still a program that the majority of cities are benefiting from, and a small amount of cities are contributing to. And then even within the contributing population, most of the contributors aren't contributing much. So there's sort of a subset of contributors who are contributing a pretty large number of tax base. And the way you can read that is you can read across. I don't know if everybody has that sheet yet of winners and losers. You can read across to see what portion of the tax base different communities are either picking up or losing. I also want to point out that I passed out the public purpose statement of the bill, I think it's called. And I guess this is a tool for all legislators to look at as to why you would never, ever want to do this. That is the handout, and I don't know if members you have it, that mentions the six purposes in this bill creation. It's Chapter 473F. Mm-hmm. And in fact, interestingly enough, I don't know if any members were here then, but this chapter shall be cited as the Charles R. Weaver Metropolitan Revenue Distribution Act. I didn't know that they even got names, but I guess they do.
You have to die first, Representative.
So anyway, we've got the handout, the short subject, the winner and losers, and the purpose. And I want to tell committee members that there is no state in the country that does this. We're the only place that does this. And that doesn't mean it's a bad thing. Minnesota is a strong believer in equalization. We probably, when you add up our school formulas that are equalized, our LGA and other credits to counties, et cetera, and fiscal disparities, I think we probably equalize more than any state in the nation. Mr. Hines might be able to tell us that, but I think on a per capita basis, there is no state that does more equalization than the state of Minnesota. So this is one of those equalization programs. And I think what I'm trying to argue here is it's time for scrutiny. 34 years, never been looked at, no state ever does it. If you can refer to the purpose document, they're listed 1 through 6. And as you read through them, it's pretty easy to see why many of these purposes are not, they're not being met. And in fact, some, I'm not aware that they're even being considered. I talked to a lot of legislators and people who were around when this passed, and in fact, many members don't even agree that this was why it passed. Some people told me that this was really basically so certain parts of the metro could get more school funding. And if you look at the purpose statement of the bill, there's no reference to school funding. And other people told me that this was really an attempt to control sprawl and growth. It's difficult, I think, for anyone in the metro to argue that that's happening. So what I would argue to the committee, and I hope we could take a look, is that it's time to just really understand what's going on in this major aid program. There's fiscal notes in your packet. I think there's one from finance and there's one from revenue. They're in conflict. The one from revenue says zero. The one from finance says $150,000. I think that number came from the Senate provision last time it was in the omnibus bill. I'm really not sure on that, and I'm not sure why some are counting it as a cost and why not, although it looks like the finance note says that the best way to do it is hire a consultant, and I would leave that up to the committee. Should it be an internal study or should it be an outside study? I did want to talk a little bit about those who might say there have been studies. We all as members received this blue book. I didn't bring them to pass them around, but these are not studies. This is the January 2005 piece of information put out by our research department that describes the program both for the Metro and for the Iron Range. It's not a study. It shows exactly how the money is collected, where it goes. There's a lot of interesting information in it, but it isn't in any way a comprehensive study, and I don't think House Research would say it is either. In fact, I've talked to them, and they say it is definitely not. One of the things that is so surprising in the data, however, in just in reporting the data, is that one of the interesting things that the Fiscal Disparities Program is doing is it's causing tax rates in communities who have very, very low tax rates. And this program was not designed to assist very, very low tax rate communities. It's working to have them have an even lower tax rate. So that would certainly not have been an objective of this program, that for those who don't have a high tax rate that they would get assistance. And that's part of what's taking place. The Citizens League is another organization who likes to weigh in on fiscal disparities. They have done a few studies, I guess they would call them. I would say that there's been lots of bias because they were one of the organizations that was the biggest advocate for creating the program and, in fact, did a lot of work to create the program, and they have a huge interest in preserving the program. Even, however, though, the Citizens League has cited many concerns, they have as well. And, in fact, one of the things that they've really been looking at of late is that there is money moving to the rural parts of the metro area that have no intention of building CI in the future. These are for rural housing, and we're seeing shifts of resources there. So I guess I'd like the committee to just think about, you know, what might be some changes that could come from a study, and what would be the objectives of the study, and I'm open to anything anyone's got. I think we've gone through a really painful process with LGA and every other program, and I don't know why we wouldn't do this one now. One of the things I bring up is there have been bills in the past by me, Representative Paulson, others, people in the Senate, to say, let's cap contributions, for example. So why not a cap? I mean, would it in theory be that we'll let cities eventually give away 30% of their tax base, 50, 90? There's no cap. That might be something we want to look at. Why was the formula set up to say that what we're going to do is we're going to take 40% of people's commercial industrial property tax base and give it to another community? Why 40? I mean, I don't think anyone's ever answered why 40. Representative Krenke is going to tell us why 40. I don't know if it should have been 20 or 80 or, you know, but why 40? It doesn't seem to be based in anything. Why do we have a grandfather provision? We don't like grandfathers here. We've got one in this. It's called the let's only count buildings built after 1971. Everything before 1971 doesn't count. That's how the formula works. What that does in effect is take huge quantities of commercial industrial tax base in the metro area and not count them. So it's kind of a reverse grandfather. It says, we'll just pretend you don't have that, and we'll forever put it into this formula. So, you know, why was that done? I mean, my guess is it was politically at the time you couldn't pass it if everything, because it was passed in 1971. So I think the only way you could probably get it through the legislature is say, well, we won't go backward, we'll only go forward. Well, how that's effectively playing out is, for example, just 10 or 15 years ago, I think about 48%, of the resources coming from the metro fiscal disparities pool were in the core area. Now it's 26. It's moving slowly out to the exurbs, and the core is not being counted proportionally because it's only things that are built after pre-1971 or before after the year of 1971. Some of the other problems with what's taking place in it is that it doesn't, when it counts growth, it doesn't distinguish between inflation growth or construction growth. Formula recognizes them equally. And probably my biggest concern that we ought to think about, and we did this with LGA, we said, let's measure fiscal capacity. the ability of communities to raise revenue versus what are their needs. Fiscal disparities does not really measure the expenditure side of the equation. It doesn't recognize pressures that come with growth. It doesn't acknowledge that different communities have different pressures on the system. Similarly, like in LGA, we put in one of our formulas says we're going to recognize overburden. If you're like a larger regional center in the state or a Minneapolis-St. Paul, you have extra costs that other communities don't have. You have libraries and parks and airports. We don't have anything like that in fiscal disparities. We do not recognize that there are costs to the communities who have large commercial industrial tax bases. I know that people who don't represent communities that have a lot of CI will frequently say to me, we wish we could have all that commercial industrial. Send it all here. And that's a legitimate thing to say. However, people who do represent those areas know that there is a service cost that comes with the business community. There is a overburden. For example, the city I represent has the busiest intersection in the state of Minnesota. It's 494 and 35W. There are more people coming to that intersection than anywhere in this entire state. There are huge spillover effects for those kind of congestion things that are taking place. I think people tend to think business communities don't have residents. You know, they don't realize that if they go behind those parking lots of all those office buildings and hotels and restaurants and retail facilities, there's houses right behind them. And there are huge spillover effects taking place in those communities, and there's no recognition of that in this formula. I would add to that that the fiscal disparities program has encouraged cities to not, quite frankly, share the responsibility in society of having a commercial industrial base. We've got whole communities across the metro who have actively taken a position that they will be a bedroom community, period. They don't want CI. They want to shop where it is. They want to, you know, go to movies where it is, and they want to go to spend time at these large facilities, but they don't want to live by them. They want someone else to have them in their community. The formula works to say that that a lot of communities can, and you can see this by looking at their tax base, can completely avoid having commercial industrial in their community and get all the benefits by just driving 7 miles over there. And so there's no recognition that there is a community cost to that. So there's a lot we could talk about related to it, and I would just ask, I think that the people who are losing under the program will always lose. I don't think this program will ever go away. I think we've learned over time in Minnesota that when we come up with big programs, they just do not go away. And I think, you know, we actually should do equalization. And I've always thought that about LGA as well. We have a responsibility to do equalization. But what I will say that I always said about those formulas is if we're going to have groups of people give to other groups, we ought to do it right. We ought to do it fairly. We ought to base it in need. We ought to base it in something. And I think it's difficult for anybody to argue that the purposes of the original legislation are being met, that the way the formulas were created mean much of anything, considering we don't include most of the commercial industrial property in the metropolitan area. When you look at valuation, we have taken everything built before 1971 off, and so we do have a grandfather clause, and then there's no basis for the 40%. I mean, there's just so many things wrong with it that I would hope that thoughtful folks, recognizing it's not going to go away, recognizing there will always be loser communities and there should be, and winner communities and there should be, should take the responsibility of looking at this. And I think part of the reason we haven't looked at this is because it isn't a state-funded program. So we think we can turn our back on it, ignore it, because it's one local community giving to another. But it is, you know, more than half of the population of the state is involved in this program. And it also is the fact that political subdivisions, cities, towns, are creatures of the state. They don't exist without us. And we were the ones who designed this program, not the cities. So, you know, I'm just urging all of you to consider doing a study of this very important program.
Any questions for Representative Lencheski? Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lencheski, first, I appreciated the privilege of the last 2 years being able to sit in those two chairs over there next to you in local government committee, and the largest net gainer, St. Paul, being able to sit next to the largest net loser, Bloomington. And we had several discussions about this, and I'm not going to go on about those ad nauseum as sometimes we did last year. But I appreciate you bringing this up. And my question for you is twofold. First, what percentage of Bloomington's net gain, or net loss rather, what percentage of the city budget is that, is my question, if you know. And second, you say that you'd like a study on this, but it seems that you kind of answered your own questions on a couple of levels, and that those questions that you brought up today, and also things that the Citizens League has done or other individuals, why are those studies, and it seems to me they come up every year, why are those inadequate?
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lesh, thanks for the question. To answer the last question first, I don't think either of those, or the House folks, again, have not said this is a study, and if you take the time to read it, it isn't a study. It's a reporting document, similar to the state auditor saying how many cities have liquor stores and what are the revenues they're getting. It doesn't have a judgment on is it meeting the goals, or should it be redesigned, or should there be a new formula. It just says, here's a law, and we're reporting back to you what the law is doing. So it is not a study. The Citizens League, again, they have a bias here. I mean, I don't think, and I think they would admit that, they might be in the room and they might testify and say that. This was an organization that worked very closely with Representative Myron Orfield and others who were trying to get at a very serious problem of urban sprawl. And they have a huge interest, and in fact, will tell you, I just read their thing, that there are no winners or no losers in this program. Everybody is a winner. And I mean, I think it's very difficult to make a statement like that and not be biased. So I can get it to you. It's 4 pages long. It's not a very exhaustive, and it is in the study. It's sort of an opinion piece. I've got it right here, and it was just produced in their Minnesota Journal thing they mail out to members like every month, and it's just sort of talking about some of the things that are happening within the program. To go to Bloomington specifically, and I know it's, you know, it's probably hard to believe, but really I do know that Bloomington is the biggest in real dollars net giver, and probably always will be as long as we just have the pre-1971. And if that's the formula, it should be. I'm not arguing that shouldn't change, but because I represent the community that is the biggest net giver, you know, obviously I have an interest in making sure that as the money is passed out, it's done so based on need, not based on something that was dreamt up 34 years ago that no one's ever looked at. So Bloomington, you asked as a percentage of their tax base, I'm just looking on the line, I think we're like 7th or 8th down on your sheet there, and it says that then after you take, we pay in 20-something, get back 6-something, so we give up last year almost $14 million. Our city budget is $40 million. We give up $14 million. That's a pretty big chunk. Now, you know, I'm not sure if I'm actually reading this chart correctly, and maybe Mr. Hines could elaborate. That could be just capacity, not the tax. So I'm not sure what the dollar amount is, and maybe Mr. Hines could tell us that.
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, that's exactly correct.
Okay.
That refers to tax capacity, not directly comparable to budget. I think the best statement, the most straightforward statement to make is if you look at the final column, the 11.1% of tax base loss, to say that Bloomington City's tax rate is 11% higher than it would otherwise be because of their contribution. It gets complicated to try to tie that into budget dollars. It doesn't come out of their budget per se. It's base, but it's that would be
right.
The most straightforward thing I think you could say, if that's straightforward.
Did that make sense?
Yes.
Mr. Hines, I think is that's the right way to look at it then. So you could take in the net recipients column, let's take like Columbia Heights. I think we could say then their tax are 15% lower because of the program. Is that correct, Mr. Hines?
Correct.
So I think we recognize there will always be winners and losers, but I'm trying to have a study to base it on something.
Mr.
I would, yeah, say, Mr. Hines.
Could I clarify one other way you could take a look at it is if we look at the Bloomington's loss of $13 million in tax capacity if their city tax rate is 25%, and I'm not sure what their city tax rate is, or 20%, you could take 20% of that $13 million and say that's about $2.6 million, sort of equate that as a comparable contribution of the city piece. It gets a little dicey to say that, but if you wanted to tie it into back to budget dollars, there is another way you could do it. But I'm really guessing at that city tax rate, so don't quote me on that. But that would be a fairly typical tax rate for a city.
I would like to direct members' attention to page 23 of, I haven't read the report, yeah, can you pass it out, of the House Research Department's Minnesota's Fiscal Disparities Program. I know I asked Steve to do this, Mr. Heinz to do this, and I'm delighted that he did this. Regional impacts. The tax increment finance phenomenon also leads to an unlikely result, namely that because the metro area as a whole essentially loses tax base when the fiscal disparities program is eliminated, metro area cities are in aggregate slightly needier as measured by the LGA formula. This result causes LGA to be $9.1 million higher in the metro area and $9.1 million lower in greater Minnesota. Kind of an interesting little twist when everybody doesn't think they got any skin in the game. But this could be just a cocktail weenie for some people, 9.1 million. But I find that to be interesting. Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to say on the question of grandfathering Representative Lincheski that, you know, given, I think, wasn't this case in the courts for 14 years or something? Wasn't it a long time? I can't remember how long.
There were four cases, Representative Rukavina. There was one, I think, was in the courts for 8 years, 75. Yeah, it was only 4 years for that one. And then there was, of course, the Iron Range case.
That was for about two and a half years.
So, yeah, this has been in the courts off and on for four or five
and
years.
And I think Representative Lincheski, going backwards, was probably a big issue, I would assume, like it gets to be in other laws that are passed. But and I understand your need for trying to rationalize why you're a loser and somebody's a gainer and what they're doing with the money, but you know, anytime we tinker with formulas around here, it scares me because it seems we make them worse. And you know, you made a statement about local government aid and that the new formula, you know, it's more tied to your ability to raise revenue versus your needs.
It's got both.
Right. But I would say, then why does a city like Hoyt Lakes that has absolutely no ability to raise money and has a lot of needs lose all of its LGA, 100% of it, over the next few years? So it's because of the little nuances that get put in the formulas. And, you know, I could go on about 30, raise, you know, what is that one part of the formula to the 33rd power? Oh, you know, transform population. Yeah, it's kind of like beam me up, Scotty, you know. And then my experimentation this year with the formula where I was going to put up the stop sign in Virginia and outrange cities, and we're going to have spring loaded, and everybody was going to be invited to hit it so we could get 1,000 more accidents, and we would have got $190,000 more dollars the next year. But they had to be over $1,000 in. You know, so now we're down to junk pickup trucks, which a bumper costs $1,000, and we're going to still put up that spring-loaded stop sign and urge everybody, and we're going to have a police officer that just writes a ticket, you know, report, and then we'll get $190,000 more LGA. But see, I mean, you know, my point being, and Mr. Heinz knows I did actually research this spring-loaded stop sign, but, you know... Oh, Representative Abrams, I was going to put out a video that you wouldn't believe, but then the $1,000 limit on, you know, at the accident had to be over $1,000, so it screwed that up, so I'm still working on other parts of the formula. But that's what scares me about your research, you know. You could try to make things better and make them even worse for Bloomington. But I commend you for not giving up, guy. You could be a ranger. You should pay dues to the Iron Range delegation because you don't give up, and I commend you at least for that, and I think we should give Representative Lincheski the money for this study, Mr. Chair, just so we get her off this issue and get her onto a new issue.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lincheski.
If I may, I learned how to fight for my community from the master, which would be Representative Rukavina. And sometimes we have to take different positions, but, you know, it is all of our jobs to fight for our communities. And when we forget that, we really don't deserve to be here. So, you know, I'm kidding, but I'm truthful in that. When I was a freshman, I would sit on the House floor and watch Representative Rukavina convince the body that the epicenter of the universe was in his district. And, you know, we all know that that's a role we need to play here, and we should play here. And I actually know that Bloomington could get helped or hurt. That's a, you know, that's legitimate. But I think a study never hurts anything. You know, just to see what's really going on. And you mentioned the court case of Representative Rukavina. And that's true, if I understand them, though the court cases took place, the concerns were about sharing tax base. Could one community be forced to share tax base with another? It wasn't about a grandfather component. It wasn't about should we not count all the buildings built before the year of 1971. I think it was really about is it okay? And remember, we are, and you represent the other part of the state that's doing it. With the Taconite, we are the only state in the nation who does this, and I think it's always okay to look at what the effect is of what we're doing.
Now, one of my favorite Tom Rukavina stories is that the entire Iron Range delegation descended onto my office when they wanted to establish the Iron Range Fiscal Disparities Region, and I said to them, you all agree to this. You understand what you're inflicting on yourselves here. You all agree to this. Remember this, Representative Rukavina? And everybody in the room, all you Iron Rangers, said, yes, do it. Within 14 months, there were members of the Iron Range delegation in my office saying, how did you let us do this to ourselves? You know how Tom Rukavina took us here?
That's not true. There was only one member of the Range delegation, and he's gone. And we didn't let him pay dues even the last few years.
Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair, my only point, Representative Lincheski, in the grandfathering part of it, and perhaps I'm totally wrong, but I think to retroactively go after the commercial industrial base would have probably been, you know, much more difficult to defend in courts. And that's why we modeled it after, when we did it, we just started from that date forward thinking that somebody would probably bring a lawsuit in to try to justify going after, you know, all of their CI way back to whenever the statehood was not going to stand up. You know, it would be difficult to defend.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Rukavina, I remember the conversations about that stop sign, and I just wondered if it was before the city-run greenhouse in Virginia or after the city-run greenhouse in Virginia. But my question, Mr. Chair, really is...
Do you like flowers? Who doesn't like flowers?
They are beautiful.
The next time for Valentine's Day, I'm going to tell your husband to give you a car ramps or something like that. So.
But, Mr. Chair, that's generally what I get. My question really is in regards to formulas. Representative Lincheski, you talk about, you know, a 34-year-old formula, and we dealt last year with LGA, which is an old formula, and we deal with the CASA formula, which is an old formula. Is there anything in law, Mr. Hines, that triggers a sunset on formulas so that it forces us to reevaluate things along the way so that we don't get so deep into grandfathers that we can't get back out?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, no, nothing automatic like that exists in law.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lincheski.
And I appreciate Representative Broad asking that. May I also mention that LGA, fiscal disparities, and the school equalization formula were all created the same year. They all came in together in 1971, and I think there are a number of people I've talked to who were there then who say that if school equalization had already taken place a couple years before that and LGA, there probably would have never been a need for fiscal disparities. But I think the legislature was sort of equalization happy that year and was coming up with all these formulas And, you know, I couldn't even tell you who the governor was then. And I think both houses were Democrats, I believe. No? Maybe Representative Abrams can tell us more about what was going on. Were you here in 1971? No.
No, the governor was Governor Wendell Anderson.
Okay.
The House and the Senate would be under conservative control. Representative Krenke, there was no party designation, so they had to call themselves conservatives or liberals. There was no hiding. And there was a special session that lasted, I believe, until October. And, you know, one of the interesting things about this law is in order for former Representative Weaver, the elder, to get the law through, there was a exemption for South St. Paul because of the stockyards. And that lasted, I think, until like 1999 or 2000. So that there was a little exemption. Not only was there a grandfather, but there was an exemption for development on a specific parcel of property that lasted for almost 27, 28 years. Representative Krenke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lincheski, in reading through your legislation, I know you addressed the issue of whether the is the Department of Revenue, are they just the ones that are going to, in essence, contract for the study to be done, or are you intending that the Department of Revenue would actually do the study?
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Chairman Abrams, and Representative Krenke. I'm open to any way that the Minnesota House is interested in finding a way to study this. And whatever this group thinks is the best, whatever the full tax committee, whatever the floor, whatever it takes, if people have strong feelings about how it should be done and have a rationale for why one way is better, then I would take that. My interest is really in just taking a look at something that has not been looked at.
Representative Krenke, and looking at the bill and looking at the fiscal note, the bill requires the Commissioner of Revenue to do the report. The fiscal note assumes that the Commissioner of Revenue has to hire somebody in order to do the report. So the disconnect here that you point out is not in Representative Lincheski's bill. It's how the administration, or at least the Executive Budget Officer over at the Department of Finance, interprets how the Department of Revenue would proceed. At least that's how I read it. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Krenke, it might be helpful to hear from Mr. Hines. I actually asked him similar questions, and I think he made an argument that it might be the kind of thing you would want somebody completely out of it to look at, but you know, Mr. Hines, do you have a feeling on what's the best way to study something like this? I think what my concern is with revenue is that, you know, it's not something that's putting money into revenue. I mean, these are city-to-city transfers, and it might just feel like, what do we care? You know, now they have to do what the legislature directs them. But I'm open to any way, and maybe Mr. Hines can just comment on what the best way to do a thorough study of this program is.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, I'm not sure I know what the best way is. I would say that I think the Department of Finance, probably in consultation with Revenue, feels that they would be better, they would rather hire someone from the outside to do it if given this job. And from my sort of knowledge of their expertise, I think that's probably a good idea. And there's a lot of reason to bring someone in from the outside to take a look at this. People in Minnesota generally have a perspective on this program that may benefit to have an outside look. But other than that, I don't have any great ideas about how to get it done.
Any further discussion? Representative Krenke.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Chesky, the reason I raised the question is that for example, on page 2 in lines 6 and 7, does the program help promote orderly growth and encourage environmentally sound land use? I've talked to a lot of people at the Department of Revenue. I didn't know that they had any land use experts there. And again, this is going to be almost more subjective information than objective information. And so I guess, Representative Lucheski, I understand why you want to put that in to the study, but I think that that's going to be fairly, again, subjective information. No matter who looks at it, that's a fairly subjective point to look at. And I know that Mr. Hines could probably give you some reference materials, or anybody reference materials on site-based property taxes. Certain people who have been studying for decades the property tax system based on the high, what is basically the highest and best use of the land. So you could go a long way down that path if you're going to try to get into what is orderly growth and environmentally sound land use.
Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Krinke, you're absolutely right. Anything, I mean, we could change this to be whatever we think would be much more objective. And part of the reason I mean, I'll be honest, I just lifted a bill that I introduced 2 years ago or 3 years ago, or I don't remember, with the same language. And at the time, we designed the language about this question based on the purpose statement in the original legislation, which is what the purpose statement said it was going to do, all these things. So if you go back and look at those six purpose clauses, it's attempting to sort of say, well, is that really happening? So we could do just about anything with it just to get the right information out here. So I know you heard from Representative Westerberg there a second, but I just wanted to clarify that do you understand? It was sort of based on this purpose statement from the original legislation. We could change it to be whatever we think will get the most objective data.
Representative Vandeveer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucheski, I wasn't here. I had to step out, and I apologize, but it does look like it's asking for a lot of opinions. I mean, the word reasonable, not sure what that is, sufficient, derived sufficient tax revenues. And maybe it should have, I mean, reasonable is all the way through here, and I'm not sure what that means. And maybe it could define some of those terms or exactly what information that you're looking for or what standard or whatever to make it maybe a little more objective.
Yeah. Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Chairman Abrams and Representative Vandeveer. I'm open to that. Whatever anyone can think of, quite frankly. I based it on those purpose statements in the original legislation, which are arbitrary and use that same kind of language. I mean, they say things like, to establish incentives for all parts of the area to work for the growth of the area as a whole. Well, anybody could say that happened or didn't. I mean, the enabling legislation sort of sets up the problem in the study, but, you know, maybe someone here knows. Did we ever do a big LGA study? And how did we phrase the language to go into an LGA study? I mean, I know there was the LAD work, but that was pre-LGA or at the same time as LGA in fiscal disparities?
No.
No?
No.
Okay, well, help us. Help me.
LAD study was in, I believe, 1989 and 1990. And I think Gordy Voss stuck in a provision requiring that to be done, and I think in the 87, I'd like to say,
tax bill. But no, that was 25 years after the local government aid program was established, Representative Lucheski, I believe.
Well, Mr. Chair, can I ask you, since you, this is the Helen Ladd study, right? And I've read a lot of that. It actually does not read like a study. Like, frankly, it reads like a book. And, I mean, I think it was called, I don't know, the Ladd Report. They actually have a section in that report, which I've read. I think it's called, like, Measuring Disparities in Local Condition. and they reference a little bit of this and criticize a few things, but it does sort of read like a book. I mean, it doesn't, you know, if we're looking at a way to make an objective study that gets objective results with Representative Kripke and Representative Vandeveer of Rays, I am open to how we do that. I just, do we have, and maybe the historians know this, and maybe it comes from the staff, when people have been able to get a study going on an equalization program, how did they, you know, do that? Do we just dump all the language that ask the questions and just say do a study and not say what we're looking for? I mean, it's complicated to figure out how we would do this.
Mr. Hines? Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, I can't recall enough about the lab study or the language to sort of bring that to bear without looking into it, but it seems like you have to sort of charge who's ever doing a study with trying to determine the objectives of the program and whether they would do that strictly by a reading of the purpose statement or other information gathering. That would probably be the first part of the study, is trying to determine what the purposes are and then trying to measure outcomes of the program versus those standards would be, you know, what the study would be about. It's not an obvious task of exactly what either of those steps would involve, but that's, you know, why it would be a fairly major effort, I think, is to try to get some of that kind of consensus information or consensus opinions about purposes down first and then go on to develop meaningful measures of that, which is what LAD did, the LAD study did.
Representative Vandeveer.
Representative Lincheski, maybe you could take the opportunity to less muddy the enabling legislation, maybe by defining some of these terms and then our goals or whatever in part of your bill, and then maybe interpret the enabling legislation as you see fit and then include those objectives. Does that sound like it's...
Mr. Chair, Representative Vandeveer, that sounds like a great idea. I just, you know, until reading this purpose document on the original legislation, I've never seen a bill like this. And I mean, we ought to have a bill to not allow these kind of bills, quite frankly. I don't know how prevalent they are through our statute and laws, but I think the real problem in trying to study this is this original legislation, so I see where you're going with that. And when somebody lays out not only a statement and then six things you're going to do, I guess LGA doesn't say any of this kind of stuff about what it's trying to do.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, it could be that the original legislation was a goal looking for a reason in the first place.
Well,
the Iron Rangers did learn from it because they don't have a purpose clause for the Iron Range fiscal disparities area. They just said we're going to do it. So, we have about 5 minutes left. Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against House File 851? Okay. Are there any more questions from committee members or discussion from committee members in House File 851? Mm-hmm. Representative Kripke.
Well, one thing I can say with regard to purpose statements, having served here a number of years with Representative Kahn, she has diligently worked over the years to remove this type of language for in legislation when people put in purpose statements. So, this was pre-Representative Kahn.
By 2 years, Representative Kripke. Any further discussion? If not, at this point, we will lay over House File 851 for further consideration and possible inclusion in a property tax division report to the full committee. Representative Broad moves approval of the minutes of the division, which took place on Thursday, February 24th, 2005. As many as are in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say no. Motion does prevail. There being no further business on the agenda, meeting is adjourned.